From Caspary Auditorium at the Rockefeller Institute in New York City, the CBS Radio Network presents The Great Challenge, the second season of CBS News Symposiums that bring together outstanding leaders from many fields to consider urgent problems facing the nation in a rapidly changing world. Today, in our final symposium for 1959, we ask the question, is the American public getting the information it needs? Again today, The Great Challenge is produced in cooperation with Sigma Delta Chi, the national journalistic fraternity, which this year is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Joining with Eric Severide, chief Washington correspondent for CBS News, are Arthur Schlesinger, author and professor of history at Harvard, Charles A. Sprague, publisher of the Salem Oregon Statesman and former governor of his state, James C. Haggerty, presidential news secretary, Robert D. Swayze, chairman of the Freedom of Information Committee of the National Association of Broadcasters and executive vice president of station WDSU in New Orleans, and James Reston, chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times. Now to our moderator, Eric Severide.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the fifth and last Great Challenge program in this year's series. Again, for the second week in a row, we are dealing with the problem of a democracy's information in a rather perilous and certainly a very complex time. This is a pretty tough and, I think, slippery question. In any television heaven, a moderator should be able to march his squad of speakers in very logical sequence through the subject matter to an unanswerable conclusion, but this never happens on Earth. At least it never happens to me. But I will make some kind of a try at having some logical outline to this program. I'd like to start by trying to establish a premise at the outset in the form of an answer to our question, the answer of yes or no as to whether we are getting the information that we need. If everybody says yes, we can all go for a walk in the park. If they say no, that people are not getting the information they need, then I think we'll have to break it down. First, then, into what kind of information is it that we're not getting that we need, and then why we're not getting it, whether that's because it's not given us by its sources or by its purveyors, the journalists, and whether, if it is made sufficiently available, we are not getting it in terms of not understanding it, and finally, what we would have to do about this. Well, first, gentlemen, let me try to get a yes or no answer from each of you to our chief question. Let me have your provisos and conditions a little later. Just to establish you all, can I get a yes or no, beginning with Mr. Schlesinger?
I think that one of the few ways which we've been able to get information is through the activities of congressional committees enforcing information which the government, by if left to its own devices, would have kept withheld from us. Only a few days ago, Senator Anderson, the chairman of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, finally persuaded the AEC to permit the Department of Defense to issue a document which reported the results of tests concerning fallout. The Defense Department document showed that the radioactive material stayed up much shorter time than we thought, and then when it fell down, much more of it fell on the United States than we had supposed. These were data of considerable interest to the American people. They happened to conflict with what Dr. Libby of the AEC had been saying. The AEC, therefore, did its best to prevent the release of this document. Anderson and the Joint Committee fought for some time. They finally, the document came out in November, finally in March, great pressure, they procured its release. Now, if it hadn't been for Anderson and the Joint Committee, that document would still be in the files of the AEC and the Defense Department, and the American people would have denied to it information which may be more intimate and decisive of our destiny and the future of civilization than almost any other kind of information.
I want to ask at this point, ask Mr. Reston, do you have the impression, as a Washington correspondent, that reporters there have had to turn more and more to congressional committees, which do have the power of subpoena, which reporters do not have, to get information of this kind?
Yes, I think we have. I think in the last 10 or 15 years, a fundamental change has taken place in the way in which news gets out. In order to get the consent of the Congress, the executive has to tell them, give them more information. The information on which the security of the country depends is more complex. It needs more explanation by the executive. Also, as an ally in a vast worldwide coalition, we have to fill in our allies on all these things. And there has been a tendency, I think, for more information to be given all the way around to congressional committees, to allies, and eventually it comes out, I think, in a greater flow. I'm not too worried about this thing that worries many of my colleagues, that there is some great conspiracy in Washington on the part of officials to keep in information, to keep information of importance from the people.
Have you ever seen a time in peacetime, Mr. Reston, working in Washington, where there had been such a glut of complaints from editors' groups, from scientists, from congressmen, about so-called withholding of news?
No.
It seems to me this is at a height.
How about that, Mr. Reston? I disagree with the words you use. You say, in peacetime. I don't think we're at peace.
Then this is a permanent condition which justifies withholding on that basis?
I think that with the worldwide threat that the free world has from communism, that this cannot be used, the word peacetime cannot be applied. I think many of these matters that we're talking about, and many of these matters that seriously concern and worry, whether you believe it or not, men like myself in government and my colleagues in the news-gathering media, it's grays. There's nothing that's really black and white. And you must be very careful, and a government must be very careful, that in a dissemination of what I think is valuable and pertinent information to the public, that that information does not become embroiled in matters which I would classify as security to our country.
And who's to be the judge of this, outside of the arbitrary judgment of people running a department, and under what legal basis do they do this?
I think that the people that are to be the judge of it are the responsible men in the government. I think that's the only way you can do it, from the president down. Now, I would disagree with my friend, Mr. Schlesinger, this paper that he referred to on fallout was forced out of the government and the Department of Defense by action of the Congressional Committee. As I recall this document, the document that was quite properly sent to the appropriate committee of the Congress had in it some of these sensitive and security matters. The Department of Defense gave the full picture to the committee, but the Department of Defense was also preparing a document to be made public with those security matters and those sensitive matters out of it.
You don't think the pressure from committees has speeded up the flow of any of this?
Well, I think it helps, and I would agree with Mr. Reston. I think this is a good system. This is our system of government. We have our checks and our balances. It's a good system. It works. At times, Mr. Reston and these gentlemen get mad at me, but at times I get mad at them. it does work, and I think each complements the other.
Mr. Sweezy, you want
to... Eric, I wonder if we could use the... I don't know how free you are to talk about this, Jim.
I don't know what...
The Argus project is the final release of information on that as an example. Now, that came out, as I gather, through the hard digging of Mr. Reston's associate, Hanson Baldwin, as much as anything else, and he and his colleagues sat on it for 7 months, as I understand, before there was any release. And in the meantime, the Senate, the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy was even in the dark on the actual fact. Now, I don't know what that situation is. It interested me very much that a good reporter like Mr. Baldwin could get all of this information, and then that he could sit on it for 7 months. This is a very difficult thing, I imagine, for any reporter to do.
Not when the welfare of your country is concerned.
Now, that apparently was uppermost in his mind.
I can't talk too much about it.
I don't suppose you can.
For one very simple thing. This was not only a scientific experiment conducted under the International Geophysical Year, but it also did have as everybody admitted, military connotations. And in these days that we're in, and in the scientific world that we're in, for a boy that had trouble with high school physics, at times I get over my depth, but to separate the pure scientific results of an experiment and to differentiate those results from those of a military security of your nation is not easy. And this scientific report was worked on by our top scientists ever since the experiment happened.
Well, now, in the normal...
With a full understanding that as soon as they could separate this data, it would be made public.
In the normal course of things, when would that have come out, do you suppose?
It would have been out. It would have been out at just about the time we put it out. And it was about ready to be made public. And I know whereof I speak because I had the document on my desk when the story was broken by the Times.
It does seem to me, though,
Eric, this is a difficult situation.
There's something indicated here that we may be falling down a little. I mean, the professor suggested that the Congressional Committee is the only way out of this.
No,
maybe,
one way. The press can play an absolutely indispensable role.
Well, maybe a little harder work in digging. For example, I'm told in the defense organizations, anytime anyone says national security, everybody lays off.
I'm sure Mr. Haggerty would agree that giving the national security pretext is an extremely dangerous temptation to hold out to government officials.
Certainly, I'd agree
and
with that.
And that, therefore, one can understand the misgivings which the public is going to have when it's confronted with it. Therefore, there ought to be some means of testing the validity of that pretext. Moreover, there are a lot of fields where the welfare of the country isn't involved at all, where it cannot be said that the directive the president gave you and which you've carried out so well has been carried out all through the government.
Well, I'd be the first to say that it's been carried out.
I think a lot of things have to do with the award of FCC channels, for example, or with the activities of some members of the government. When Governor Adams was in the White House, he used to suggest that acts of his own were in some sense acts of the president, and therefore no one had any right to find out what they were. Seems to me
I don't
that,
think it was as simple as that.
Well, I condense a not very much more complicated constitutional argument, but it does seem to me that there are a lot of things which don't involve national welfare or national security, where I think my colleagues in Washington would say they have a lot of trouble establishing the facts.
Well, I think also, let's see if we can try to get this down and see if anybody agrees with me or not, but a government many times is in the process of formulating a policy or a decision. There is much work and much study that goes into this before a policy or a decision is completed. Then, Washington being what it is, sometimes while those discussions are going on, Mr. Reston or people working in Washington will get a segment of that. This they try to guard against. And they know full well that it isn't the complete picture or the complete discussion, but it is news. They print it. The government has not finished its studies, has not finished its decisions, and normally when it happens, and it happens frequently to me, I would just say, well, I haven't anything to say about it. It is being under consideration, which is a Washington word that means anything from let's forget it to it really is under consideration. And until that policy is completed, as far as I'm concerned, until it's approved, if it's up that high by the president, I don't say anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Reston.
Jim, this is one of the things I think that disturbs every thoughtful newspaper man in Washington today. I can remember when I first went to Washington, Mr. Hull was the Secretary of State. In those simple days, he had a press conference that lasted 45 minutes or an hour every day. I remember once asking him about a treaty that was in negotiation, and he said, don't ask me about that. When we finish with it, we'll present it to the Senate. then the Senate will be free to reserve or in any way change it, and you can criticize it all you like. I think in those days, he was perfectly right in saying that to us. But what happens now is something quite different. The government within the executive goes through a long period of interdepartmental discussion. And during that phase, they say to us, keep out of this. And then they go through a long allied discussion. And they say, keep out of this. And then they present it to the Senate. And if it has something to do with foreign affairs, as it almost always does, once it is announced as executive policy, they say to the Senate and they say to the press, for goodness sake, don't change this, because if you do, it'll be a great victory for Khrushchev. Now, I believe if we are to have the, if the democratic process is to work effectively, we have to submarine under there, Jim, or what happens is what happened with the Eisenhower Doctrine. You present it to the Senate or to the Congress. As soon as it is presented, the Senate did not really have actually freedom of action to change that. If they had, it would have been a great embarrassment to the administration. Now, is this a problem? It seems to me that it is.
Certainly it's a problem. But the image that you portray of an all-powerful government presenting as a fact without debate these momentous questions of our time, particularly those dealing with foreign policy, just isn't true. There is public discussion, there is discussion within the halls of the Congress, and certainly there is discussion within news media of our country. On the presentation to the Congress, I think that the administration has tried to keep the pertinent committees of the Congress as informed as they possibly can. But the United States and its president today is in a position of world leadership in the free world. And as a government of the United States, we must discuss this with our allies if we are going to get concerted action. And if we are going to get action that does not divide us and present a divided picture to the world. This is necessary. This is also a problem. And from where I sit, I honestly think that that we do try to keep the members of Congress informed, and I think that there is considerable more debate than you would indicate in just what you just said.
Well, are we coming to the point here where more and more only rather highly educated people can really understand the news of our universal fate, the news that we're getting every day? Is the complexity and volume of this outrunning the rise in the average and normal level of understanding? What do you think, Mr. Esmond?
I think, yes, I think we are coming to that point. I think a fundamental thing has changed in this country on this very point. I remember when I first went to England as a reporter being astonished at the passivity of the English electorate, coming from a part of the country where everybody second guesses Washington, has a chip on its shoulder, is naturally skeptical as the American people have always been. This astonished me. But I think we're becoming much more like the English now in our own attitudes toward government. I think I have the feeling, it's a disturbing feeling, and it may be wrong, but I have the feeling that this country would support the president if he sent an armed convoy into Berlin, or if he made a deal on Berlin, or support him on Quemoy and Matsu, or support him if he abandoned Quemoy and Matsu. I think this is something new in American life. At least I feel that there has been a fundamental change due to the complexity.
A sort of a washing of hands on a mass scale of...
I disagree with that.
Go ahead, Governor, and I'll get you...
I think there was a very different reaction among the American people to the Kamoi Matsu affair than there is to the Berlin affair. Very different.
If you're on the West Coast, you're probably more conscious.
Eric, may I support Mr. Reston on this? And let us take an example of information which is rather clear. And I'm speaking of the farm subsidy. For example, we've all been told quite clearly, quite unmistakably, that it is costing the government at the present time $1 billion a year to store rancid butter, to store wheat, which presumably will never be used. And for some reason or other, the public never doesn't worry about this at all. $1 billion is an awful lot of money. And as far as I can find out, and I've asked everybody I can think of, including Senator Ellender, who so far hasn't given me any satisfactory answer, why does this thing have to go on? Now, here is a thing that's very easy to understand. $1 billion a year is being spent for no useful purpose. Now, the public take this, Jim, apparently, and it's stride. They're not at all concerned about it. Now, this worries me. I don't know what's happened to that beautiful thing called righteous indignation. I think that was a fine thing, and I hate to see it lost. Now, this is passivity, an extraordinary passivity. Why is this? It does exist. And this isn't because the news is not understandable. It is understandable, for example, that all these hoods and hoodlums that are daily revealed in the McClellan hearings control our labor movement. But is the public exercised? Apparently not until a bomb is thrown in one's front yard.
He's going a little further than I would.
Yeah. Well, maybe I have. I'm trying to make a point.
No, this is a question of degree, it seems to me. What I'm thinking of is that when Woodrow Wilson went into his grave, he was convinced that such was the feeling in this country against strong executive action in foreign affairs that never again would another major treaty pass the Senate. When Walter Lippmann wrote The Good Society, he pointed to the fact that the people would not allow the executive to do what the executive knew it had to do in order to save the country from its foreign and domestic enemies. And yet, since the end of the war, I can think of no country in history that has changed so much or done so much or got so much support from the people. I think this is a good thing. The only thing I'm saying is that the executive can now act in a way that I don't think it was ever possible for it to act before.
You see any danger in this? Suppose you had an executive headed by a very, very determined or ruthless man. Would this passivity allow him to become what are now called the coming age of Caesars?
I would hope that it would not, and that the instinct of the country at that point would rise to protect itself against improper use of executive power. But I think this is one of the dangers. If my premise is correct, that there is a new passivity, that it could go on and cause trouble at some time in the future.
You know, Eric, I really think that some of this discussion puts the premium on American intelligence pretty low. I haven't any doubt in my own mind that Americans, as a public, are more aware than we would give them credit for what's going on in this world of ours.
I know you mean that, Jim, because I know you're not running for office.
No, I'm not. And there, to say that there would be passivity if the President of the United States would make a deal or surrender on Berlin, I just think is impossible.
I must say that I tend to agree with Mr. Haggerty in his last remark. I do think, though, that I agree with Mr. Reston on the general phenomenon, but I think that where Scotty perhaps overstates its significance is in assuming that there has been a kind of irresistible tendency of which in this direction over a long period. I would think that the passivity in which we are in many respects, is rather a cyclical matter.
And actually, we've alternated through our history between periods of passivity and periods of activism. You have a period of passivity, and a lot of things pile up that have to be done, and eventually the dam breaks, and you have periods of activism. The first 20 years of this century were periods of activism. The next decade, the decade of the 20s, was passivity. You had 20 years of activism from the 30s and 40s. You've had a decade of passivity in the 50s. And I think that after time, we get exhausted as a nation. Our capacity to respond to public crisis becomes enfeebled. We've had one thing after another crammed down our throats. Our moral and political responsiveness is drained. Then after a time, so we go into a passive period. And then after a time, our energies become replenished, our batteries begin to be recharged.
Where are we?
And I think
right
the process
now
of the recharging of batteries is visible. I think that we're going to enter a period of forward motion again, which will make the passivity as much of a memory as the passivity of the...
Let's raise one other question that we haven't touched on. Let's take this information from the government and talk a few minutes how it's presented by the news media.
We have about 2.5 minutes, Jim.
It takes longer than that.
You quick, 30 seconds.
Quickly and being impartial. Radio, television, and the newspapers. How can a newspaper present world affairs in a half a column roundup each day? How can a newspaper, if a government official makes a mistake, and I make them frequently, I'm on the front page. If the newspapers make a mistake, the correction is back in the warrant ad. Now, why don't we correct it on the same page that the story appeared on, and I would prefer under the same byline of the man that wrote it. Let's go to radio. How can we have a worldwide roundup each morning and each evening from the listening posts of the world and the capitals of the world, and to have a man in 1 minute tell me how every Britisher, how every Frenchman, how every Russian is feeling on that question that day? It's a good trick, but you can't get away with it.
But actually, there's a great deal more of news coverage and analysis of the news in depth in television and radio than you give us credence for, Jim. I don't think we're doing the full job any more than the newspapers are. I think this is a job for all of us, and part of your job, too. On the other hand, I certainly don't think radio and television have too much to apologize for relative to the other news sources. I think they're doing a very good job. And I think, by the same token, they'll do a much better one.
May I ask just one question?
Yes, sir.
Have you ever heard a correction of a false news item on radio and television?
Oh, by all means. We do it all the time.
I'm not listening to your station.
Be delighted to do it any time you'll miss
both. Gentlemen, time has run out. I want to thank you all very much for being with us. And thanks to all of you in the audience for coming. Good afternoon.
CBS News has presented the final symposium of the 1959 Great Challenge series. These programs have called on outstanding leaders of thought for appraisals of our democratic institutions in a time of great scientific and technological change against a background of intensified Soviet competition. Thanks to the hospitality of Dr. Detlef W. Bronk and his colleagues, The Great Challenge originates from Caspary Auditorium of the Rockefeller Institute in New York. For more than 50 years, the Institute has been devoted to the furtherance of human welfare, and that is the basic theme of this series. Again today, The Great Challenge has been produced in cooperation with Sigma Delta Chi, the national professional journalistic fraternity founded in 1909, which this year is celebrating its 50th anniversary. The Great Challenge, produced by Stephen Fleischman, is a public affairs presentation of CBS News. World traveler, prolific author, and one of radio's foremost news personalities for 3 decades. That's distinguished CBS newsman Lowell Thomas, whose special brand of news reporting and commentary is heard over the CBS radio network each weeknight. Hear the latest news from around the world. Hear fascinating human interest stories and colorful personal sidelight commentary. Hear Lowell Thomas each Monday through Friday night on CBS Radio.